The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Leconte.
We're joined this week for the first of the new season by Professor Phil Cowley. Since 2016, he's been Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University and Director of the Mile End Institute. He's a regular on Radio 4 throughout the night on election nights, and his new book is The British General Election of 2017. Phil taught at Nottingham University and before that at Hull, and he's originally from Bristol, where he was educated at Filton College. Now, this is important because he went to the same school as former comedian and convicted harasser Justin Lee Collins, Welsh rugby player Scott Baldwin, but most importantly, Sajid Javid. Welcome, Phil.
Yeah, is all of that true? I mean, is all of that legal? And is all of that true? Those are the two questions I was thinking as you were saying that.
I think we should focus mainly on the Sajid bit. Yeah, that is great. Now, you're in a class with him.
Well, we were at the same college together doing A-levels. Yeah, but not the same school. I have to. He went to an even rougher school than me. But we were at the same A level college.
But I feel like you've got quite a funny story about that, but which you've told me and I'm putting in my book. So if you could not tell it now, that would be very helpful to
me.
Fine.
Thank you. Fine. Wait for Marie's book. It's brilliant.
Let's just summarise it.
So good. Like the sex, the violence, the guns. Yeah.
And that was just at Queen
Diana.
Mary. Did you look at him and think, "There goes a future Home Secretary"?
The really embarrassing thing is neither of us have any memory of the other being in the class at all. So normally these stories always end with, I looked at him and knew he'd go far. In this case, we looked at each other and just completely forgot about each other for about 20 years.
Oh, right. So you didn't create a hostile environment at the school
There was no hostile environment at Filton Technical College, except from all the people who resented the A-level students.
But now knowing what you know about people from your area, and from your background as a political scientist with a specialist in British politics, do you have a sense of which of his bodyguards he's sleeping with? Because I watched a documentary about this on the BBC recently, and apparently it goes on quite a lot.
The bodyguard programme was one of those examples where when you don't watch it, and then there's a real buzz about it, and you think, everyone's talking about this, I'm much watching it. It's always rubbish.
I want to start with the news from this week. First off, universal credit. Now, it seems to be causing a whole lot of trouble. Gordon Brown was writing in the Daily Mirror, said it was cruel and vindictive. The government should abandon universal credit or face poll tax-style riots. This is amid reports that families could be £200 a month worse off. There's loads of data on this, and it's pretty consistent that the majority of the public support reform of the welfare system, but they can't agree on how. And in that sense, it's kind of like Brexit, in that if you work on the assumption that it is going ahead, and obviously we could debate that for until the cows come home, but then no one can agree on how that works.
But isn't the issue, so like, I'm admittedly not an expert on welfare policy, but the fact that universal credit as an idea and as a policy could have been okay if very complicated, if Osborne hadn't effectively raided the entire budget for universal credit in the years after that was put forward. I mean, that was kind of my understanding of it.
I have a theory that this is one of those policies which sounds great, lots of people support.
Polls great, and
in the abstract. And yet when it actually happens, it's okay until it starts to affect you. And then when it starts to affect you, it doesn't work. And at that point, the everything unravels.
Yeah,
and it seems to me, and here's how I would draw a parallel with this and Brexit, which is that at the moment we are getting lots of polling about Brexit, what Brexit means in the abstract. I mean, poll out today saying that, you know, people don't mind the peace process unraveling in Northern Ireland as long as it means they, in quotes, take back control. That's a perfectly fine thing to say in the abstract until bombs start going off, and at that point I just think it you will get very quick shifts on public opinion if some of these things come to pass. And I think that's probably true of most of the Brexit polling. It's telling us actually very little about what people will think if things start to go wrong.
And then also there's the whole question about how people would vote. That yes, you may see a move towards Remain, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people would actually turn out and then actually vote Remain at the end of a campaign for a second referendum, for instance. But that's a whole other.
But all of those questions which ask how might you behave if something happens, they're usually the easiest to ignore of all polling questions. I mean, people are terribly bad predictors of their own behaviour at the best of times. Under hypothetical circumstances, they're even more likely to misread what they might do, it seems to me.
And actually, a lot of the polling on universal credit just emphasises this, because when you look at it in detail, you see that people massively misunderstand how and where the money goes, how it's handed out, the levels that are spent, how it's distributed, the levels of benefit fraud. All of these things the public have very little understanding. Not that that's a criticism, it just shows the complexity of the issue.
But the one thing I do find interesting, actually, on benefits is how little, actually, comparatively, Corbyn's Labour has done on it. Because, you know, since Corbyn has got in, his thing has been, you know, I do have those issues. I don't really care if they're not popular inside the bubble or kind of, you know, controversial inside the bubble, but I care about them very much. And, you know, I'm just going to, like, push through with them. And weirdly, like, I think you would have expected, surely, benefits and, you know, the reversal of benefit cuts to be part of that. And actually, like, when you look at the shadow DWP team, I could not name the Shadow Secretary for Work and Pensions right now. Debbie Abrahams, I can't remember the single thing she did. And it's quite like, just looking at the kind of politics of it, it's quite interesting how not hard Labour is going on that.
Is this a battle that actually any party can win?
Well, what's the battle, though? Is the battle to
reform,
give people different...
Welfare and benefits.
You can reform it, but are we...
in a way that makes it better.
Okay, but what does better mean? I mean, does better mean getting more people back into work? Does better mean lowering the overall bill? Does better mean prioritising funding in different areas? I mean, all of these are definitions of better, and your benefits reform is attempting to trade some of these off against other ones whilst keeping a decent level of benefits to everyone. I mean, I just think it is easy to reform the welfare system. It's not easy to reform the welfare system in a way that people are happy with at the end of it. It's a little bit like that scene in the very first episode of The Thick of It, where they're in the back of the car and the special advisor, he's annoyed at that they're asking him to produce a catchy policy at the flick of a wrist. And he sort of says, you know, oh, so all you want is a popular policy that costs nothing and everyone likes. Oh, yeah, I've got dozens of those. They're in a folder. I mean, they just don't exist. And I think that's particularly true with...
Universally popular, but cheap and plays well with
War with France.
Apart from War with France and bringing back the death penalty, it's difficult to think of very many cheap popular policies.
Speaking of something that's cheap but not necessarily popular.
Same.
A bakery in Belfast has been the subject of a Supreme Court ruling. This has come out recently. They've ruled in favour of a Christian family bakery in Northern Ireland that refused to bake a cake which said on it, "Support gay marriage." The judges ruled that freedom of expression, as guaranteed by Article 10 of the European Convention, but not sure for how much longer, on human rights, includes the right not to express an opinion which one does not hold. And they added that the court has held that nobody should be forced to have or express a political opinion in which he does not believe. The bakers could not refuse to supply their goods to Mr. Lee because he was a gay man or supported gay marriage, but this is quite different from obliging them to supply a cake iced with a message with which they profoundly disagreed. It's really technical, but strangely, the public have a view on this as well. 56% believed at the time when this first came out back in 2014 that it was acceptable for a Christian bakery to not provide a support gay marriage cake. I've realised that when I wrote this in my prep, I didn't include a question, so I don't know what to say about this.
But the interesting question would be if you flip the polling question round and you asked, would it be okay for a gay baker not to bake a cake with an anti-gay marriage slogan on it, whether that would poll differently or not. Because that's the underlying principle here.
In both cases, according to the Supreme Court, it's acceptable.
Yeah, because the Supreme Court is arguing it's the message, not the supplier, of the nature of the person that you're supplying the good to.
Exactly.
I was just going to say that I actually agree with the court ruling, I think, because again, like, there is a difference between just saying, you know, that is just a cake for a marriage that happens to be a gay wedding. You know, obviously, I think in that case, bakers should just have to make that bloody cake. But when it comes to a political slogan, I can see how, you know, the opposite would be worrying.
In my understanding of the ruling is that if a gay couple asked a baker to bake them a cake for a gay wedding, so with two male characters or two female characters on it, that would the bakery could not refuse, even if their own religious or moral standpoint somehow objected to the gay wedding, that they would have to provide that service. It's the slogan that is the issue here. Now, I agree with you. In one sense, this is quite technical, but a bit like Marie, I find myself thinking that actually maybe the Supreme Court's got this one right.
Well, actually, on refusing goods and services, there is actually data that shows that that's not completely objected to by the public. Around about a third of people, for instance, think it's acceptable for bed and breakfast owners to turn around and not offer their services to gay people if they have objections. Even 16% of people say restaurants, 14% of people say taxis or minicabs should be able to refuse. So it shows there is still this, although it's relatively small, there is still this proportion of the British public that actually believes it should be up to the individual organisations.
I do wonder where the age breakdown would be on that, because I would suspect that actually there's probably a bit of an age gap in terms of like those minorities.
Right.
And, yeah,
I haven't got that data.
You could also try again poll that question, but you take out questions about sexuality and stick back in race or gender to see how far attitudes have changed. Because I suspect 30 or 40 years ago, you'd have found similar proportions would have had absolutely no problem with the idea of, before the Race Relations Act, of a white bed and breakfast owner refusing to have a black person come and stay in their house. I mean, I suspect the proportions would have been bigger in, say, 1955, 1960.
Speaking of things that were popular 30 or 40 years ago, ugh, Bob Geldof, that's a good one, that's a good segue, has brought together a team of celebrities, a crack squad including Rita Ora, Ed Sheeran, Sting and Simon Rattle, all as part of an anti-Brexit campaign. This comes at the same time as, across the pond, Taylor Swift posted a politically charged Instagram post for the first time, and this has supposedly been linked to more than 65,000 voters registering to vote in the few days that followed, which was more than the total for August completely. We haven't had in this country much in the way of celebrity activities among sort of younger celebrities for political stuff. Do you see this as a sign of changing circumstances and the new shape of things to come?
No.
That's the spirit.
I mean, God help us from celebrities and politics. I mean, it's one of those things where every time a celebrity gets involved in politics, we get media coverage of it, agonized op-eds about whether this matters or not. It usually makes no difference at all. The Taylor Swift one is more interesting, but I would love to see what happens actually after the, you know, let's see after the midterms whether there's a Taylor Swift effect. You can imagine all of those desperate academic papers published after the midterms in which they've leveraged in Taylor Swift lyrics into the title in order to try to make themselves sort of trendy and useful and have a wider appeal, all of which will fail.
But well, if it does fail, I guess they can always just shake it off.
In Venice, I was trying to work on something along the lines of, I knew you were trouble when you walked in, like the Trump presidency or something.
Look what you've made me do.
There's no doubt, obviously, that the age divide is something that's being heavily discussed in British politics at the moment. It dominated the party conferences. In 2015, around about 41% of 18 to 25-year-olds voted for Labour. That was up to 62% in 2017. According to the British election study, more than 7 out of 10 voted to remain. Phil, you've done work on young people involved in politics. Is there a way to get them more interested and more engaged in politics?
Well, I think the really interesting thing at the moment is the extent to which age has become the big dividing line in British politics in a way it never used to be. There always used to be a sort of age gradient, but it's massive now. There was that line which used to get knocked around in A-level essays about class is the basis of British politics, all else is embellishment and detail.
I'd like to say I did that both at A-level and at degree level.
And I used to want to ban it because it was the thing that the mediocre student always went back to in their essays. But
it's a bit harsh. Job is at Sheffield rather than Hull.
If you were to take it and you know, adapt it. I mean, age now is the fundamental difference in British politics, and all else is secondary to age, it seems to me. Now, the thing that I differ from some of the writing on this is that too much of this focuses on the 18 to 24-year-old. It focuses on the really sort of youngest voters. And these are people, on the whole, who have still pretty low levels of turnout, despite all the guff about a youth quake at the last election. The really interesting thing is not what's happened to the 18 to 24-year-olds. It's what's happened to those 25 to 30 or in their 30s or even those in their early 40s who have become not those in their late 40s over this side of the table, almost 50. It's that massive cohort of younger voters, because there's, you know, you can lose the 18 to 24 year olds and it doesn't matter. You can still win comfortably. You can't lose all of that cohort up to about the late 40s and still hope to win an election. There's just not enough older voters.
But wasn't it like, because I did this panel at a Labour conference around, I think it's like the renters quake. If I remember correctly, I think like the group that was the most likely to vote Labour was not even just young people, but it was specifically renters, when actually renters have just flocked to Labour in a way that, you know, we'd not seen before, which is quite interesting, because I think, again, that's not just the 18 to 24 year olds, but that's people who, yes, can be in their late 20s, early 30s, and who are still, I think, still have the same lifestyle, I guess, as people would normally have at about 21, 22, so kind of like unstable jobs, and again, yeah, sort of like shitty, sort of like rented rooms in like overpriced flats, etc., etc. And you can sort of see how, yeah, again, the kind of political matters that would swing stuff, I think, for much younger voters originally, now are relevant as well to people who are older than that.
Well, this is the big discussion in political science about the age effect, the cohort effect, yes, or the period,
yeah,
effect.
Yeah. And also, what is driving this? So, I mean, I think Marie's right. So there's definitely a values difference there. There's the Brexit issue, which also overlays all of this. And then there's the economic situation of people in their 20s or 30s. And some of the things that previously might have maybe changed their political attitudes, such as getting a mortgage, getting a home, those things, getting onto the housing ladder is becoming increasingly difficult. And so those things aren't kicking in exactly the same way they might have done 20 or 30 years ago.
We're joined now by Sarbjit Bakshi from Smarkets. Hello, Sarbjit.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, we're good. Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us about Smarkets.
Smarkets is a betting exchange. We're passionate about politics and Smarkets. So we have the largest number of politics markets that you can bet on of any betting exchange that we know of. We've got great technology. It's a great app you can use on your phone or a great website. And we have one of the lowest commissions of any betting exchanges.
Great. And could you explain to both our listeners how a betting exchange differs from a normal bookmaker?
A normal bookmaker is you against the bookie. So there's odds, there's commission, there's overheads that they're going to factor into the price that you pay. With a betting exchange, you're free to be either side of that contract. So if you don't like the prices that are available on exchange, you can offer better prices and other people can take them from you.
And what are some of the things that we should be looking out for on Smarkets at the moment?
So we have all the major political events. We've got a big, big push on the US midterm elections. You can bet on all gubernatorial races, all the Senate races, and most of the interesting House of Representatives elections.
And is it just people in the UK that can do this, or can they do it elsewhere?
Well, it's mainly UK audience. Anyone based in the UK can bet on these kinds of things above the age of 18, of course. We operate in a few other countries, like Sweden, for instance, but not in the US currently.
What do you think is the most interesting market at the moment other than the US midterms?
Specifically, the one that keeps giving and giving is when Theresa May will officially cease to be leader of the Conservative Party.
MLC, what's your bet for that?
I will absolutely not bet on that. I have been wrong about so many things in the past few years that I refuse to make any predictions of any kind.
Well, if you ever visit my house, you can sit on the Theresa May memorial sofa that was won as a result of me betting on Theresa May last time. So I'm hoping to get more furniture from this time around. But I think it's even
Jay's
more difficult.
Been sleeping on a mattress for months. Theresa May, please leave. He says you will.
What do you think Theresa May's going to do?
So with Theresa May's exit date, we have the 12th of August onwards from 2018 was the most likely date for her departure. Between the 16th of December and the end of 2018, we got a real high point for that. Then from the 1st of April onwards was when 2019 started to take over. Then 9th of May, things flipped again. 2018 was back on top. Then on 29th of June, 2019 came back on top, with the 5th of July marking the lowest 2018 contract price in our market. So 2018, 2019, but since then, 2019's been number one, really.
Sounds like people don't really know.
She, to give her credit, she can hang on much longer than anyone else can ever hang on. I think no one has expected this.
I find that really relatable. That's been me in every job I've ever had.
She's done a good job of keeping people on their toes, certainly. We have the US midterms coming up. What are, apart from obviously the Brexits of this world and the Theresa May leaving, what are the big political events that we know are coming up in the next few months?
There's been a lot of questions around the Brexit market. We've had six markets on Brexit in Smarkets. things around whether there'll be a no deal, whether there'll be, you know, what will be the actual exit date, whether the Prime Minister will see it through, whether Ollie Robbins will resign in between. These are all events that kind of cloud things about what's going to happen next. In terms of big political events, Brexit kind of dominates the agenda for the UK. The US, obviously.
We know the feeling.
Yeah, it's hard to think through anything else. Government's not passing a lot of laws at the moment. It doesn't risk taking its majority into Parliament. So we're looking at other elections. We've got the Bavarian state elections.
And ooh, ooh.
It is the greatest thing to come out of Germany since Oktoberfest.
Just can't wait. I've got an advent calendar for the Bavarian elections every night.
It's a heartwarming story, the Bavarian state elections. I think we can all agree, because for a long time, the AfD were considered to be, you know, might come as number two to the CSU, which would be a terrible, terrible time for all of us. What has changed is that the Green Party have just shot up and may actually take the second place and maybe even eclipse the CSU for control of the regional assembly there.
Fair enough. That is genuinely really interesting. I withdraw my snark.
And if people want to sign up for Smarkets, how do they do that?
They go to the website, click on sign up.
What's the website URL?
www.smarkets.com.
Great. Phil, your new book is out. It's entitled The British General Election of 2017.
What's it about?
We worked for ages on the title.
David Dimbleby describes it as the Bible of general elections. Does that mean that the Gideons place it in every hotel room?
It means there's two volumes and the first volume is much more miserable than the second.
Oh, that's... We all, I think anyone involved even tangentially with politics, has a story about the 2017 general election being announced. It was, we were all coming back from our nice Easter break, and then everything went a bit crazy. Marie, do you recall where you were when that election was announced?
I do. I have two stories. The first one being that, so yeah, we knew there was an announcement. We didn't know what it was. We knew it was going to be big. And I was still working at BuzzFeed at the time and I was on the news desk. I was like, okay, whatever happens, I'll probably have to be like stuck to my desk for quite a long time. So that I'll just pop by the bathroom before it starts. And you know, it was 11, I can't remember what time, went there, except that she started the speech early, so I came back. And so for the rest of time, we'd be like, where were you? It's like, I was peeing. I was peeing when she announced there was a general election. And the second thing was that I'd quit smoking, it'd been 9 months at that point, and I had a vape. And then she announced the election, and I was not very happy in my job at BuzzFeed, so I was like, nope, fuck that. And so, like, typed up the piece about the election, left, went to the corner shop and bought some fags.
So Theresa May, from what I'm interpreting from this, is responsible for your lung disease.
She is. No, as I have told several special advisors.
Fair enough. Phil, I imagine you have a story.
I was on holiday. And
Where were you on holiday?
We were in Portugal, and I'd promised my wife that it would be a proper holiday and I wouldn't do any work. And I had just got
that work out for
I had just got to that point. You know, when you go on holiday and it takes you a couple of days to unwind properly, and then I just got to that point where I'd kind of properly beginning to unwind and relax. And we'd taken the kids to the beach to go swimming. And we've got two small kids. And it was the first time they'd really got waves. We were on this lovely beach in Portugal and they were splashing in the waves. And it was lovely. It was really enjoyable. And the thing that nobody tells you about parenting, which I'm not sure I should reveal in case my kids ever grow up and listen to this, is
that, sure
they will grow up. I mean, they will grow up, but they might, you know, they might have better things to do. Most of parenting is a bit of a grind, but it's interspersed with these moments of joy, like sheer joy.
A
bit like this podcast. And that hour on the beach with the kids splashing in the sea was like pure joy. We then came off the beach, we were toweling them down, and I noticed my phone had buzzed, and I looked down, and there were just loads of messages, and my heart sank as I picked the phone up. And the first message read, fuck. The second message read, oh, fuck. And the third message, and this was the most prescient of all, read, you're fucked. And I sat there on the beach, near the beach with the towels. And it was a bit like that scene in Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels where he's playing the card game and he loses the card game and everything shifts behind him. The whole of his world sort of goes wonky. And I could just see the next sort of year and a bit as I had to write this damn book stretching ahead of me. And I remember thinking that hour on the beach was really happy. When will I ever be happy again? But the even worse thing is, as I then tried, in that way you do with loss, you try to bargain your way out of the loss. I remember thinking, okay, this is terrible. This is really terrible. I don't want to have to do this book now. I've only just recovered from doing the 2015 book. But at least it'll generate a big majority for the Conservatives and things will be stable for 4 to 5 years after that. There is at least no risk of another early election, I told myself. That was the first of many things I got wrong about the 2017 election.
And so this book, tell us about this book series. It's been going for many, many elections now.
Well, it dates back to 1945, and there's been one of these books at every election since 45, and the great David Butler was involved either as author or a contributor to every single one from 45 to 2005. And then after the 2005 book, David stepped down and I replaced him, and I write it with Dennis Kavanagh, who's been involved in every one of them since February 1974.
In 74, did they do one book or two books?
They did two books.
Wow.
74.
Wow.
They did.
You had it easy.
Oh, they did. And they just managed to get the February book out before the October election was called. However, speaking to Dennis and David about that, what was different then, as opposed to between 15 and 17, or even maybe now, was that it was clear immediately after February 74 that there was going to be another election. I mean, they knew that there was going to be another election soon in a way that we didn't in 15. And I think still kind of now we're not entirely sure whether there is going to be another election. So they knew they had to basically knock this book out very, very quickly, which they still did. It's an amazing achievement, but which they did.
And what process do you go through to write a book like this?
Well, I suppose one of the key things...
After obviously the horror and
after
the horror,
after the horror, after coming back...
Crying, lots of gin. Writing the book is the sixth stage of grief.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I suppose differentiates, at least from a lot of the other academic writing on elections, is we do loads of interviews. So, you know, I have 150 interviews for this book. For the 2015 one, I think we did 300 interviews.
But presumably you know the election's coming.
What we normally do, which we weren't able to this time, is you do loads of interviews before the election with people, not really to get very much out of these interviews, but to build up relations with them so they know who you are, they know they trust you and so on. And then you go back to them afterwards and say, well, look, you said this 6 months ago, but what do you really think? And then you get more out of them. And some of these interviews are, you know, they're repeats. So some people we see, you know, 5, 6, 7 times to go back over really over detail. And I suppose that's the big difference. You also can't keep the same structure all the time. So, I mean, this time we have a chapter on Brexit, for example, which we obviously didn't have in previous books because that kind of shapes everything that follows. We have a chapter solely on the calling of the election, which we begin the book with. And then it's a process of writing, interviewing. And the book is a mixture of that and more sort of traditional academic quantitative work. So there's a big appendix of about 20,000 words long of John Curtis and his colleagues doing an analysis of the results. And then, you know, it's about 200,000 words long in total, about 600 pages, and it's ruined my life for 18 months.
The main thing this week that we want to talk about is the fun and games of the party conference season. Marie's been coughing all day because it's come and gone for another year. Are you suffering the post-conference lurgy?
Yes. Well, I mean, it started really at the end of Labour conference. So Tories was quite fun. I had to chair an event and I could just feel like physically how feverish I was while I was trying to talk to people about stuff. And I just could not remember like the end of sentences or anything. So it was fun.
Well, research shows that fewer than a quarter of people say they're paying attention to the conferences. And I think even that, the 22% figure seems awfully high to me. There's been no significant movement in the polls. The polls now have Conservatives basically neck and neck with Labour, or perhaps slightly ahead, as they were before the conference season. But the conferences, we have to say, I mean, for me personally, they provide an opportunity to do things that I don't do normally, such as eat at Pizza Express.
Oh, God, so many times.
I ate at Pizza Express 4 times in one day at the Labour conference. At that Pizza Express, I had 2 lunches and 2 dinners. So I get to do that. I also get to sing karaoke, which certainly only happens at a conference. I sang with Owen Bennett this year. Phil, do you ever go to party conferences?
No, I'm very delighted.
That was forceful.
I was very forceful. No, I don't. And It always clashes with the start of term.
Otherwise, you'd be up there like a shot.
It's always difficult. Some academics do go, and I'm never quite sure how they manage to fit it in around. But for me, it's just, you know, even if I wanted to go, I kind of couldn't.
I saw Tim Bale there. He's at Queen Mary. He's a lazy shit.
We
obviously have a difference of opinion.
If you're listening to this, Bale, you know, I've got your number. I do, however, go to Pizza Express a lot. One of the things that happened when
this is what's called on the podcast doing an Adonis, which is just dragging things back to what you want to talk about.
No. When you've got kids, you go to Pizza Express a lot. And I remember actually just before we had kids, we suggested going and eating with someone at Pizza Express. And the other couple just said, no. Because once you have kids, you'll be in there once a month. You know, you'll be sick of the sight of it. You don't want to have any more dough balls. Let's move on. I don't go to potty conferences. I don't know if I miss very much. I can get hungover anyway. There's always anyway, because of the start of term, a thing called Fresher's Flu, which, you know, you get hundreds of mainly 18-year-olds who are living away from home for the first time, not looking after themselves properly. They all go down with terrible bugs within the first sort of week of arriving at university. They cough all over you. You end up with a cold anyway. I can get a cold from my students. I can get a hangover down the pub. I mean, I don't really see the point of party conferences anymore.
I would say fear of missing out is one thing, but also they do provide an opportunity for a lot of people. They provide an opportunity to do things that they can only do at conference. So whether that's meet politicians, debate with like-minded individuals, have sex, you know, all of these things, a lot of the people going can only do at conference. And so I think that is an important role. Do you think they're here to stay? We mentioned the fact that they perhaps don't serve the role they once did. They're not particularly good at bringing in lots of people. Are they here to stay in their current format?
I think they kind of will remain. So I always find it fascinating how many, you know, the fact that basically every political journalist in the land will be at party conferences, even though there are no news. So there'll normally be maybe one or two fringes a day where one sort of like very, like, you know, junior minister for paperclips will say something dumb. But, you know, in that room, there will be three journalists anyway. So like, but it's really interesting. So I have done party conferences as a political news reporter before. And it's an absolute nightmare because you've got your editor down the phone, like in London, who's like, you know, where are the stories? Which, fair point, you know, fair thing to ask for a news editor. But also there are no stories and all the journalists are still there and all the media organisations spend so much money putting up their kind of journalists there for no reason.
And of course the parties do make money from this, so I guess they're not going to turn away the cash cow, right?
Yeah, although I do, you know, what would happen if, for example, one news organisation just said, right, sod it, we're not going anymore. I mean, the wheels would not fall off that news organisation. They would still be able to report stories. The senior political journalists would still have their contact. And they don't need to go to party conferences in order to speak to these people. For me, it's up there along with, and some of these, you know, this isn't going to happen either, but I'd get rid of the budget. I'd get rid of the Queen's speech and I'd get rid of party conferences. All three of them don't actually serve any function. And in some cases, they actually are worse than if you remove them.
So do you think they're anachronisms or just not useful anymore?
There's a good question as to whether they were ever useful. Labour's was formally useful, at least as a policy-making body, but...
Because if you're going to vote on policy, it's best to do it while really hungover.
Well, really, really hungover in a big hall. I mean, everybody knows that's the best way to make policy. I'm not even sure fulfills that function particularly well. The Conservative one is, and always has been, essentially just a rally, even if one which has a purpose. The thing as well with the parties is that it's not just this conference. I mean, they have multiple conferences. So
Spring forums.
Oh my God,
there is a rolling program of these events. You could actually, ironically, you could lose the major one and you would still have mechanisms by which people kept in touch with their party and so on, and they'd probably be better.
Once I was like, okay, you know what? No one ever goes to like Tory Spring Conference, like Spring Forum, whatever it's called. But there's going to be stories there. There'll be no one. And I can't remember what I did the night before. I think I got quite trashed. So I woke up feeling absolutely dreadful and sort of went there. And actually, yeah, no, turns out there is a reason why journalists do not go to the Tory Spring Forum, because it's hell on earth. It's a very, very, very sweaty room with all the activists who are not fun enough to go to the real conference. And then the speech from like the candidate for, yeah. Normally, I think there was literally a speech by a candidate who wanted to become a police and crime commissioner.
Aim high, son. Aim high.
Yeah. Well, actually, of course, it's the speeches that are the big the big events, the landmark events of these conferences, when it comes, but only really when it comes to the leaders nowadays. Phil, Theresa May's dancing, good or bad?
Well, terrible dancing, good distraction technique, I suppose. And again, actually, I wasn't watching it live, so I can't, it was one, again, it was one of these things where you, I've got this theory about PMQs, which is that if ever you are not following it live and you then see on Twitter, they say something like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn smashed it this week or Theresa May brilliant this week. You go and watch it. It is never as good or as bad, never as good or as bad as people say. And it seems to me that the same is true of party conferences. So if, you know, I remember, because I wasn't following it live, suddenly seeing all this stuff about, God, she's dancing. What, you know, and she didn't actually dance. She sort of vaguely waved her arms about a bit. I mean, it, well, you
I think
know,
that counts as dancing. Well,
it's the way I dance. Marie looks like she's about to collapse.
I don't know. Like, so I've still not watched the first two videos of Theresa May dancing in their entirety because physically I can't. It's so uncomfortable for me to watch her dance that I could not watch those videos. So when she did it again, I was like, come on. But also I do kind of feel like the first time she danced, it was kind of like mortifying but quite sweet. And then the second time it was like, okay, you know what, I'm going to lean into it and properly do it. And that was quite endearing. Like the idea of it, again, I've not actually watched it, but you know, I feel like that's my idea. But then the third thing is like, you're milking it now. You know, it's just like there's only so many times you can do like, hey, you know, that thing I'm really bad at, but in quite a sweet way. Like, you know, just do it again and again and again. Jeremy Corbyn might try to dance at some point.
Do you think as a sort of retaliatory action?
Oh, God, Vince Cable is actually a
Vince Cable can dance.
Professional dancer. Yeah. So.
Vince Cable can dance. Ed Balls can dance. And when it comes to singing...
Peter Mandelson can dance.
When it comes to singing at the various karaoke events that take place, there are some really, really good singers in between the... I mean, the truly dreadful, truly, truly dreadful singers. Matt Hancock last year was willing to sing, but this year only Happy Birthday now that he's in the cabinet. It's strange how that interacts with the karaoke.
This year at Labour, I have absolutely nothing against him, but I did end up in one evening listening to Labour MP Kevin Brennan sing four times at two different parties, and it was like there's only so much singing one can take. I did really enjoy. Who was it? It was Angela Rayner and Johnny Ashworth. A Labour conference at the Mirror Party did a great duet.
I was talking to someone about a Conservative MP, and I said, "Oh yeah, he bought his own guitar to karaoke," and they looked at me and said, "What do you mean?" And they thought it was a euphemism, but it was actually that he had bought his own guitar to karaoke. Yeah, Bob, well done. Phil, what proportion of Britons do you think, if they had to choose, would describe themselves as rich or poor?
I hate these questions. I am assuming most people go for poor rather than rich.
You're right.
By 3-1.
Not quite right. Marie, what do you think?
I would say 65% rich and 35% poor. Other way around.
29%
yeah.
Rich, 52% poor.
That was quite close.
Yeah, you were quite close. That's how the country divides. And we this is exclusive polling from Delta Poll, which we ran for reasons that I've now forgotten. but we asked whether people thought that they were rich or poor because of certain advantages in life or because they worked hard and that sort of thing. What I found interesting was that 11% of people said they were poor because they didn't work hard enough. They're just freely admitting, yeah. 1 in 10 people says, yeah, I'm lazy. That's why I'm poor.
I respect that. Yeah, I like those people.
84% of people of poor people who describe themselves as poor say it's beyond circumstances, beyond their control. And 24% of people say they're rich because of certain advantages in life. So they're willing to fess up and say, yeah, it's not because I work hard. It's because of this.
Okay, but most rich people think they're rich because they've worked hard.
Yes, oh yes, yeah.
And most poor people think they're poor because they haven't worked hard enough.
No, that's right. And indeed, that's in contrast to the general view, which is that people are rich because they had certain advantages in life. A majority of people believe that, not because they work hard. Only a third of people think it's because they work hard. But nearly two-thirds of people do think that people are poor because of circumstances beyond their control. So the poor are poor because of circumstances, but the rich are rich because of also circumstances and the advantages they have in life.
I mean, who gets to be invited on a podcast like this? You need advantages in life.
Okay, that's it for this week. Just time for a quick look at some of our photos from the party conference. Look at that one. thank you to Phil Cowley. The book is The British General Election of 2017. There's no time for an interview with Melania Trump. Thank you to Subject Bakshi. This episode was sponsored by Smarkets. We will be back next week. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled P-O-D-O-T-P-O-D-S.com.